The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank.
Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work and fierce determination have changed society, lives and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. In each episode, we'll be talking to an extraordinary woman about the experiences that led her to create the organisation, fund the charity, launch the campaign, or raise the profile of an issue that she simply couldn't sit by and allow to go unnoticed or underserved. We'll discover what motivates and moves her, the challenges she's faced, the joys she's experienced, the plans she has, and the lessons she's learnt along the way. We'll also hear the sometimes surprising and funny answers to the four quick-fire questions we ask each of our extraordinary, ordinary women. I'm Effie Ezekiel. I'm a youth mentor and educator and one of the presenters of this very special podcast. Later on, the other member of our gang, Leonie Mellinger, will be talking to one of the Women of the Year lunch guests, who you most certainly will have heard of, about what makes the event such a very special and inspiring experience. Now for this week's guests. In the celebrity seat, we have Phyllis Logan, and we are so thrilled to chat to Phyllis. And this week's Extraordinary Ordinary Woman is someone who heads up a charity supporting survivors of brutal mistreatment and terrible injustice. Today's guest on Women of the Year podcast, Extraordinary Ordinary, we have Sarah Ward, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Black Country Women's Aid in the West Midlands. She is a dynamo, supernova, changing, supporting and helping women and children in her area. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today? Are you doing well?
I'm absolutely fantastic. It's absolutely great to be here.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing your story with us today. So I'm just going to get into the first question because I know we all want to know. So what was that direct route that you took into working with the Black Country Women's Aid? What was the impetus?
So I trained to be a housing officer. I went to university, trained to be a housing officer, was a housing officer for a local authority. And in my role, I dealt with lots of people who were homeless. And one of the things that came through my front door was lots of women and children that came through as experiencing homeless, and we rehoused them and all of those things. And I thought, wow, I didn't realise that this was such a major issue. And my own personal circumstances changed when my partner became really unwell. I got a young kid at the time and I needed something that was maybe a little bit nearer to home. I was absolutely gutted because I felt that there was a real passion for homelessness and helping people and housing being, you know, an essential component of, you know, good quality housing, but actually saw on my doorstep a job as director of what we were called then is Sandwell Women's Aid, and literally down the road from me. And I remember being interviewed by some of the founders of the charity and thinking, my goodness me, you know, these people have set up something really amazing. They offered me the job. And I walked into the refuge as we had at the time, and, you know, every woman was homeless and I felt at home. I felt that I'd come to a space that I brought everything that I had from my previous experiences and jobs and everything, and could really put my heart and soul into this space, because every woman that I saw and met was homeless and had a different story to tell. But the thing that sort of brought us all together was that they were victims of domestic abuse in the space that I managed. And that was my first introduction to Sandwell Women's Aid. We now call Black Country Women's Aid.
Oh, and how it's grown. And so you saw this, you had this sense of community, sense of belonging, and creating a home for women who had lost their homes. So going forward, how was the progression? What did it take to then build up this organisation to what it is now? Because you serve all of the, you know, West Midlands, which is such a big and vast area in the UK. You know, how has that gone? Because it's a mission, I can hear. It's a real passionate mission for you.
Do you know, back in the day, so I've been doing this about 20 years, back in the day, our communities allowed refugees to exist in a corner of the world that then denied that domestic abuse was happening or refused to accept it. In the 20 years, what's been really important has been to connect with every woman that has been in our service or experiences domestic abuse and hear, you know, make sure that their voice is heard. And it made me feel we were only a small refuge. It just made me think we have to do so much more. We have to do so much more. We can't just sit here, because there must be thousands of people out there experiencing violence and abuse and have nowhere to go. So I, with the support of a hell of a lot of people, you know, basically took our organisation apart and rebuilt it so that we could be there for women and children. And then when somebody says to me, our local rape crisis service is closing down and the funding's not there, you sort of think that's not good enough. We have to do something else. So we'll look after rape and sexual violence victims. And I says, no, you can't do that, Sarah, because, you know, you only do domestic abuse. You only run a refuge. And I remember thinking, don't tell me we only do this. Tell me that, you know, something is possible. And so all the time you get to a space where somebody says, no, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. And you think, why not? Why not? If the need was addressed, I'd be really happy. Somebody else do it. Fantastic. Make sure the service is really good. But it wasn't there. Then when we talked about, you know, women we talked to were stalked, you think, okay, we do domestic violence. There's nothing for stalking. Well, do you know what? We're going to do that. When there's something for, there's very little for women who enter into the criminal justice system and then they're treated within that space, maybe not so great, but actually have experienced loads of trauma and abuse and nobody's listening. Why can't we do that? And throughout the whole of the journey of Sandwell Women's Aid into Black Country Women's Aid, so now we do cover the Black Country and the wider West Midlands, there is no abuse that somebody experiences that they can't walk through our door. And that's what I've wanted to make sure, is that we've got a door that is open for any woman that is experiencing abuse. And that's been the real driver, is that it's not about what, you know, defining the abuse. It's making sure there is a door that you can walk through, get help and support, have a friendly face. You know what? Just a cup of tea sometimes. Somebody to tell, this is what's happening to me, and we will believe them. And that's been the real driver. Don't say no to me. We will get forward. We will make it happen. Don't say no.
Don't say no. And you know what? I feel because people said no, that spurred you on to then be able to help. Is it nearly 8,000 women that are coming through your doors, you know, over the year? And I realised that, you know, you've got to have a real sense of self and a real sense of purpose, but also kind of a fighting stance. So where does that fight come from? What is it in you or that you've experienced that you just don't give up? What is that? Because we're all looking for it.
Do you know what? I don't really know. I, you know, was a child that, you know, was never, you know, front of the class, never put my hands up, never being the sort of, you know, in everybody's face, not any noisy, wasn't somebody as a teenager that was, you know, out there doing everything for the first. But, you know, you're quietly sitting and seeing things around you and sort of seeing things that just aren't right, but don't know what to do about them. And you're sort of building up this experience of thinking, do you know what, I can do something. I don't know what it is. And I think when I see, I suppose housing was one of the things that, you know, everybody needs a decent house, so and everybody needs a decent home. So I did qualifications that enabled me to go into that. And I know that the thing that is important is hard work, you know, the ethic of hard work and the value of people. And those two combinations, if you value people, wherever they come from, and people can fall upon hard times at any time, is that, you know, everybody needs somewhere safe, decent to live in. And you know what, whoever you are, I felt a connection with people that I, you know, I'm here to help, serve, support, whatever. And over the years, I've grown in such confidence. And I do feel that the position that I'm in, you know, I have to use my voice, because despite the 20 years I've been here, I can tell you only yesterday, there are still some really bad attitudes about women and children who experience violence and abuse. There's still attitudes about deserving abuse and blaming women. And you just sort of think, I'm in a position now where I have to stand up. And in the 20 years of this, of people saying no, you sort of think, do you know what? If I'm against the system, I'm going to challenge the system to make it happen. Come across some real, you know, this, you can't have this, know your place. What place? You know, what place should we have? Women should have a place. You should hear and listen. But, you know, the system is often designed and developed by someone else, and we don't have any influence. So I'm using my position and I'm using my passion and commitment. I know I don't know it all, but I'm using it all to make sure that we're at the forefront, we are heard. And that's been it. You know, when somebody says thank you, when somebody says, we had a situation where one of our clients passed away in one of our services, and she was an international client, and we tried to get hold of family members and all that sort of thing, and she was alone. And we said, we are her family. We will make sure she has the respectful burial that she would have wanted, very sudden death. And the women in our service says, do you know what, Sarah, we feel safe. And we said, oh, that's really good. You know, I want you to feel safe. I want you to feel supported. They says, no, we feel safe that if we die, you will look after us. Black Country Women's Aid, you and your team will look after us. So whatever happens, we are safe. And that's really important for me to have keep the values of why we do what we do to help people all the time. And that's been the driver. And that's been the important role and the position that I hold. I've maintained that, and I'm really serious about that, because whatever we think it has changed, things haven't changed, and we still have to fight, and we still have to champion it, we still have to make a noise.
Thank you. And you know, for all the championing and making the noise, I also want to ask you, with family, you know, you said you have this family that you've created at Black Country Women's Aid, but also how do you mix that with also raising your family as well? Because having to, you know, we always have to juggle this. And then for you to have such a senior position, so you're managing hearts, you're managing people, you're managing, and it's not just that, you know, people with heavy stuff and then having to go home as well. How does that all work together? What's the journey been?
So I said I had a husband who was unwell, and sadly he passed away. But he became part of the family of Women's Aid. And at a time when, you know, we didn't have anybody to set up our IT, he helped set up our IT. When we had no money to paint the walls, me and him painted the walls of the refuge. My kids came in at the weekends and played with the kids in the refuge so that, you know, I could get on with doing some stuff that was needed in the refuge, because I needed to do other things in the week. You know, we all did things together, you know, go and see the Blackpool Lights as a family. I brought my kids along. I've got two boys. And what's been important to me having boys is that they respect women, have a value that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, you matter. And believe me, they are like that. And then sadly, my husband passed away. And what was important to me was the family that we had really embraced me and the tragedy of the sudden loss of my husband. And actually it felt that I, you know, yes, my family had lost somebody really important and really inspirational and a really good man, but actually this family enveloped me and helped me get through that. So my family is interchangeable, and it's really important we talk about work-life balance and all that sort of thing, and it's absolutely crucial. But actually, family matters, you know, people matter, you know, the space that we work in and live in, you know, connects, and it connects for me. So it's interchangeable. And I know when people work at Black Country Women's Aid and they go, I always hope they go on to really good things. In fact, an ex-colleague of ours has become quite a senior position. And she says, you know, she says, can you help me? I said, of course we can help you. We never lose contact. You know, I will always help wherever you are. And she's moved, you know, quite a distance away. She says, I would never have got here without your help, support. So we nurture, we parent, we support, we encourage, we motivate, but each other all the time.
All the time. So the women that come in, but also the staff as well, and keeping up their morale, even though they're having to deal with a lot of subjects. Because I think a lot of the time when we, you know, when we help others, we forget the impact that it has on us. So how do you keep sturdy? I'm not, you know, resilient isn't ever the word that we can really use for who we are and what we have to deal with. How do you keep yourself going and motivated? What, you know, every day after you've heard a harrowing story or having to support one of your staff members, how do you take care of yourself?
We talk a lot about self-care in Black Country Women's Aid. And what's really important is, you know, yes, we have access to professional help and support. Yes, we have access to clinical support and supervisions. And those are really important. There's been times when I've had to take time out and talk to people about this. This is actually affecting my ability to do my job, and I need to talk it through. And you have to offload, and you have to be honest about things affecting you, and different things will affect different people and different triggers and all those sorts of things. Is that you just have to be honest with yourself to sort of say, at this moment, I'm not doing too well. I need to step back a bit. I need to look after myself. And I need to know where to go to get it. And that's not being a failure or not being strong enough, or that's being honest. And I think if I'm honest, you know, people will see that, you know what, nobody should hold all of the things that we have to hear. We have to offload them. We have to share them. We have to find safe spaces for ourselves. And I certainly do that. And I have colleagues who are counsellors that, you know, I'll ask for some time. You know, I've had professional help myself because, you know, different things affect self-care. And it's so important, so important. And it really helps. It really helps work through to survive the next day, because I want to be here. I want to be here and ready, vibrant, lively to hear the next woman's circumstances. Because if I'm not, I can't help her.
I know, right. And unless you do have that kind of care and love for yourself, you're never going to be able to help anybody else. So if we move forward, just thinking about how the services that you offer women, these are ones that we don't talk about in public, but I think they need to come to light more, because I think, and I know that many women, close friends I know, close, you know, women that you may pass, have dealt with or seen domestic violence, sexual violence and assault. I think it's high on the agenda with young girls now, and the culture that they're living in on online and social media. So I would ask you, how can we do better to serve women in these circumstances? What can we do as a community? Because you can't do this all alone, and people who run all the other charities shouldn't have to do it alone. What's the best thing that we can do in order to help women?
I still don't hear this collective, we stand up against violence and abuse for women. I don't hear that collective. You know, the pockets, the noise that are really, they are really loud, and so they should be. But this collective ownership of our communities, both men and women, to stand up and say, we don't tolerate this. We have, there's nothing that really holds us all together to say, we don't want this. And by not doing that, it still allows the behind closed doors. It's still, for some people, the shame that they feel, so that they can't share. So there is something about standing together against violence and abuse. There's something about recognising it is a gendered crime. It does happen to women far more than it happens to men. And the whole thing, our streets do not feel safe for women. What are we going to do about it? It's not about street lighting. You know, a street light didn't hurt or harm a woman. It's people that hurt people. And it doesn't feel that we have a collective voice. It feels we've got a selective voice and selective hearing about the issues that are affecting women and girls. And it also feels that the same old, you know, I might be the same old voice that is championing it or challenging it. And do you know what? I'm happy to be the same old, because it's still happening. It's not ended in any way. In fact, in some respects, you know, things have become far more complex with the internet and all those sorts of things, and certain expectations that young girls have of themselves, is that, you know, some of it is, you know, job done. No, it's not job done. You know, we've got a different fight on our hands, I feel.
Do you think it would education of men is better? We need to start educating men on and boys and how to treat women, because I think it's a really big topic. And, you know, I don't know, it's just a view.
We do need to educate boys. Yeah. We do a whole education program that educates both boys and girls, you know, about respect, about what's acceptable, what's a healthy relationship look like, boys to be challenged about their behaviours, but for us also to understand the sort of pressures that both boys and girls experience. And we've got to understand, not tell, but work with young people. So yeah, absolutely, boys' behaviour, attitudes. But I'd much rather do it in an encouraging, nurturing, understanding way than telling, you know, this is wrong and this is the way it should be, because I don't think you get anywhere like that. So healthy relationships, understanding, you know, acceptable behaviours. We do have to start young, and somehow we have a really, either a postcode lottery or a patchwork quilt of, you know, inconsistency in educating our children, young people, on these issues, even though it's supposed to be mandatory. The messages are mixed and inconsistent, or stop start. You know, if we're genuine about young people, you know what, we start at four, we carry on when they're each year and building up as part of their child development. We build up. My child was different at 10 than he is at 16. You know, they need different messages, they need different challenges, and they need different people who inspire them so that they can learn and develop rather than being told.
Absolutely. And you see, because you raise boys, but they've been brought into a heavily female environment when they come and work with you. Do you think that's impacted them and the way that they see women and, you know, the stuff, the values that you've installed in them in the way that they move forward as young men?
Oh, absolutely. My boys are feminists. They are champions of injustice. They are political. They're ones to stand up in a crowd and make the noise. They are ones to challenge, even when everybody else may be of the opposing view. They've developed some really strong opinions, and they've been put in positions that are sort of says, well, why would you say that? That's for girls. And you think, my oldest son has stood on his own and sort of voiced it, and doesn't matter who he is, he will fight injustice. There are times when it's to be in his detriment, but I'm very proud of the boys that I've raised and the experience that they've had and the people that they've met. And they have been inspired by, you know, survival, how people have survived, how kids have maybe not had everything they want, but the determination to, you know, to get through. So they've seen all of that. I'm really proud of them.
I just also wanted to ask you, because you had quite a different experience last year for our Women of the Year awards and the luncheons. So we couldn't, of course, have it all together in person. But I just want to hear what it felt like for you to be there and be part of this really brilliant ceremony.
Well, first of all, I was really surprised when I got the letter, and I was thinking, you know, is this for me? And then you think, it's addressed to me, it's got my name on it, it's got an invitation that I've now got to click on a button to join. And I'm thinking, no way. So I was like really, really surprised, honoured to receive the information through the post. And then we get to the online stuff. Well, I'm not suggesting I took to online work really comfortably, but when we all clicked on and you see all these people and amazing women, And actually there were some celebrities and famous people, you sort of think, wow, I'm part of something that's really big, important. And it was a complete privilege. And I loved it that we all saved our boxes for the day and everybody, you know, opened up their bottle or were eating their scone. A really, really special day. And do you know what? I think I probably needed it at the time, because we were going through some really difficult times. I think we were trying to make sure that whilst everything closed down, that we reached our women and that needed us. And it just consolidated this whole thought that we're all trying to do our best. But it was a great afternoon. I had a fabulous table. Really, we had Nicola Walker. She was on my table, the actress. She was lovely. But everybody else just recreated the atmosphere, really did. Lost nothing from the event.
Oh, I love that. That makes me so happy and full of joy. So hopefully we can have one all in person for the coming year. And I also just want to ask you lastly, you know, about the demand for the services at the Black Country Women's Aid during the pandemic. You know, we know it went up sharply with regards to domestic violence. And we know that happens in football matches, especially when our teams lose. So what was it like for you during those times and for women?
So during COVID, a massive increase. You mentioned about 8,000 the previous year. We're up to just under 12,000 connections with Black Country Women's Aid in the period during COVID. We did a lot of work to connect through social media. We set up web pages, text chats and things like that. We reached out to people in service, and we knew that lots of people were coming to us that had never shared before. You know, everybody closed their doors and, you know, women felt locked up, and there was some real brutality and horrific experiences from women and then subsequently their children, you know, and homeschooling and all the pressures. I mean, we had one woman who told us that the only way to educate her children was to take her children into her car. And so she would do her lessons on her phone with her child in her car. So really, really difficult times. And we've made sure that, you know, we're getting feedback on our services to see how can we connect, what can we save that was positive around last year and learn about the experience. But some really horrific experiences, you know, locked in, locked up. That's how it felt. And, you know, coronavirus, you know, wasn't something, it was something that gave permission for abusers to just carry on. And the confidence that, where are you going to go? Who are you going to talk to? You know, usual places that might have been open are closed. You know, we work with supermarkets, pharmacies, all the sort of key places that, that victims could get to, just so that we can make a connection. Supermarkets were incredible, you know, stickers on prescriptions and things like that, so that the message went out, because how else were we going to reach somebody who was locked in, locked up? Tough times, really tough times. But yeah, increasing violence and abuse massively. And then the court closures meant that people who were ready to go to court, and it's a really big thing, and they get really anxious about it, and then the court date is postponed. And that was really tough for many of our victims of rape and sexual assault. You know, so experiencing justice, I think, was not felt.
Okay. Right, so I have two more questions. One being, what would you tell a woman now who's listening to this podcast and is just afraid to go and get help? What is the one key thing that she needs to know that it's okay to ask to be helped at this moment in time?
First of all, she's not alone. She's not the only one that's experienced it. And, you know, and that the door is open. The phone will be picked up. The text will be answered. That there is hope. And you don't have to suffer in silence. We're here.
All right, brilliant. And then lastly, what is your future plans for yourself or for the organisation? What's your future vision?
So I've got two things, because one of the things that Black Country Women's Aid has done is it's given me a wonderful opportunity to develop something and create something. And I, you know, I started off with probably about six staff. We've got 180 staff. And one of the greatest achievements that I feel that I will have, you know, really be dead proud of is who takes over the role that I'm doing, and the legacy planning and making sure that the work that we started, you know, with the trustee carries on. Then that's what a movement is. It carries on. It's not dependent on one person. I'll still be noisy. I'll still be who I am. So what do I want? I want to build a future for Black Country Women's Aid, you know, using the skills and talents that I have around me in all the amazing people that work in Black Country Women's Aid. I want that talent to be, and I say to the staff, you should want to sit in my seat. That's where you want to be heading. If, you know, career development and opportunity is, as you were saying, when are you going, Sarah? Because we need more. We don't need to stop, start again. So that will be an achievement. And you know what? I would absolutely love us to develop this wonderful women's centre that is full of energy and joy. And yeah, services for victims of abuse, absolutely. But actually just brings women together.
So what I'm going to ask you now, it's serious stuff, but I'm going to give you a few lighter questions now. So these are the four questions we ask all of our wonderful, extraordinary, ordinary ladies. First one is, who is or are the woman or women who have inspired you?
You know, I've been asked that question a few times, and I'm going to say I'm inspired by ordinary people and the things that they do, and the So I'm inspired by ordinary people, and I don't mean to be dull by that. And I'm going to say, of course, you say your mom. Your mom, what did my mom do? My mom just said, be the best you can be. That's what I say to my kids. Be the best you can be. No pressure, no judgment, gentle nurturing, be the best you can be. And that helps shape who I think I am. And I have a brother and a sister. I think that I've met people who have really, in my profession, I've met people who have really sort of fought to get to the place that they are. And actually, without treading on anybody, but actually women in managerial positions, and I know that the hard slog and judgment that they've had to get to where they're at, I'm inspired by them. And I remember having one female director, and I remember in many meetings, it would be that she would ask the questions that often would be interpreted, these are the stupid questions. And I remember everybody looking and sort of thinking, God, don't you know that? Don't you know that? And do you know what? She says, I'm asking the questions all of you want to ask. And that bravery, you know, to stand up and to be in a room of, you know, majority of men, I thought, wow, that's real strength. And I took so much from her, that experience, to sort of just say it. Just say what you want to say, because everybody else may be asking or wanting to ask that question. And then I've met people who... just in this job, who inspire me every day. You know, the decision to leave a home, the decision to take your kids out and move half the way across the country and to start again, and the difficulties. The woman who has no recourse to public funds and she needs to get away, knowing that she has no idea what's going to happen to her next. But actually, you know, she survives, she rebuilds her life. And some women come back and talk to me and say, you know, 20 years later, I've been doing this. And, you know, I've seen some, and she's taken qualifications as a job. You know, kids have grown up, gone to university. And you think, wow.
Wow, absolutely. You've
made life good for yourself. Be the best.
Be the best that you can be. That is our anthem of today and moving forward. It's beautiful. And it is those ordinary, we say ordinary people, who really change and make our life pivot and inspire us. So the next question, what one piece of advice would you give your younger self?
I probably was anxious and shy and didn't see a sort of place for me. Was just, if you'd have spoken to me, I would have just curled up into a ball and just said, oh my gosh, don't talk to me. And I would just say to myself, it's going to be okay. It's okay. It's okay not to be top of the class. It's okay not to be the most popular person. It's going to be okay. Just take each day at a time. So I think I would tell myself that, because I probably sat in my bedroom thinking, oh my gosh, you know, who's going to employ me? What am I going to do? Am I going to get any exams? You know, just anxious and very, very shy. Not that you think it now.
Yeah. I love that. So everything is going to be okay. And it is, you know, my one is all is well. And I just have to remember that regardless of what chaos is happening in the background of life. So what's the one thing you can't live without?
So I seem to do a lot of running around. I'd love to say a lot of running, but I'm not an athlete. I'm not particularly fit. So I have to have the most comfortable shoes. I won't name any names, but, you know, Skechers or Flip-Flops. That I have to have comfortable shoes, because I remember, you know, having, you know, supporting a woman in refuge, but having to pick up my kid and being the one that drives down the road like a mad woman, parking up in a really crazy way that probably is, you know, I should have a ticket over, and running down the school to get my kid, who he's the last one, and nearly going outside the head teacher's office because we're late again. So a good pair of shoes that keeps me running around, soft sole shoes that let me run around to all the places, because I cut everything so fine, because I just want to make sure I finish one job completely, that I'm satisfied, and then I'll run. And running down to the school gates to pick up my kid means I need comfortable shoes.
Yes, you do. Comfortable shoes for life. And so you get to the next destination. So I love that. Okay. And then the last one on this question is, what's one thing that would surprise people? So what's the one thing about you that would surprise people?
I love tap dancing.
What? Okay.
So I would have sat in my room as a shy young person watching all the old 50s musicals and the dance things, and the music was fabulous. And the women and the actresses, now we know, had all the challenges that they had as actresses, just getting through the industry and achieving these things. But tap dancing.
Tap away. Is that tap away for 2022, I think.
Thank you.
Wow, what a champion and role model Sarah is for women and girls. Absolutely amazing. Hello, I'm Leonie Mellinger. I run my own business as a communication skills advisor, and I'm an actor. Now it is my great pleasure to welcome the wonderful actress Phyllis Logan, whose expectations of Women of the Year lunch were quite different to the reality. I began our conversation by explaining the ethos behind our Women of the Year podcast.
We're having a series of podcasts and we're interviewing a series of fascinating women. And
what are you doing with me then, for God's sake?
Because you're a fascinating woman. That's why.
Try telling my husband that then. No, he does find me fascinating, I have to say.
What I'd like to start with is, I know that people have an expectation of what they think Women of the Year is going to be like before they come to it. And I wondered, before your first time of attending Women of the Year, what was your expectation of what you thought Women of the Year would be like?
Well, if I'm honest, I would say that I imagined it might be a lot of women, quite strident feminists who don't take any prisoners and who, you know, that you feel that you have to sit an exam before you go about just how much of a feminist you are, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, it completely squashed all my, you know, stupid worries or expectations when I got there, of course. I can't tell you, I know this is a very overused word, inspirational and inspiring, but if ever a word was more fitting to that event, it's this one, because you come out walking on air, you just think all these fabulous women who, you know, they're not trumpeting their own worth, they're doing something because they have a passion for whatever it is they're doing. And they don't take prisoners, but not in that, you know, strident way. They are so focused on doing what something that they know is absolutely right and proper and decent for our society. And it's absolutely thrilling. And one of the first time probably I met, and we all were invited to hold hands round the tables and join with other tables and hold hands, and then just gave a huge big whoop. And I can't tell you, I get tingles just thinking about it. It was absolutely extraordinary, just a wonderful experience.
And do you think we still need organisations like Women of the Year that celebrate women of achievement? Because this was started over 60 years ago.
Well, I'd like to say no, but, you know, just listening to anybody who's a supporter of women, Helena Kennedy, for example, she would say, no, we do need organisations. I'll tell you why, because back then we were on a very unlevel playing field with men. And I don't think that's changed. It has come on a little bit, but we still are not on a level playing field. And so as long as that's still the case, we have to have organizations like this. We have to keep pushing ourselves for, you know, the best we can be, the best we can achieve. And it is so wonderful to see these women from all walks of life, some who start off little things within their communities, when they see there's a lack of support for children or with special needs or anything, they do that. And then you have these other women who basically put their lives in danger, living in a patriarchal society where women are just the bottom of the heap, but they've stuck their necks out to, you know, possibly end up in prison and being tortured. You know, it's awful, but you have women from all these spectrums, and they're all heroes in their own way, heroines. And I love to see that, just people who are absolutely, well, not embarrassed, but they get up there and thinking, gosh, I don't deserve this, but they absolutely do. And I think they realise that more when they have these 400 women clapping and cheering them for what they've done and what they've achieved. And I think it inspires them to go on and to go on and on doing what they're doing. So it's a great event altogether.
It absolutely is. Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you again, Phyllis. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, you too, Leonie. Let's hope we can do it again at a Women of the Year lunch.
Yes, in person.
Yes.
Yes, I look forward to that very much.
Me too, so that I can come walking out on air as I do every time.
The Extraordinary Ordinary was brought to you by Women of the Year. To find out more about the organisation and its history, the lunch and the Women of the Year awards, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk or find us on Instagram and Twitter at Women of Year. For more information or to support Black Country Women's Aid, go to www.blackcountrywomensaid.co.uk. Many thanks to our brilliant producer, Claire Lynch, and to you for listening. And if you've enjoyed this podcast and listening to Extraordinary Ordinary Women, please share with your friends.
The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank. For nearly 40 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of innovative businesses and their investors move bold ideas forward fast. With tailored financial services and expertise, Silicon Valley Bank helps address the unique needs of the innovation ecosystem across all business stages. Learn more at svb.com/UK. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.